This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Just ahead this hour, we'll be looking at a set of agricultural practices that put a priority on ecosystem health, animal welfare, and economic and social justice. But before we dive into that, we want to catch you up on a story that caught everyone's attention just as we were heading into the holiday weekend. Russian hackers infiltrated a computer at Burlington Electric Department. The initial reports on this story from the Washington Post were somewhat alarming and led some people to believe that the electric grid itself had been hacked. Not so, says Burlington Electric. We're joined by the utility's general manager, Neil Lunderville, to explain exactly what happened. Hi, Neil. Nice to have you here.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Can you just very briefly recap how you actually discovered that this malware was on your employee's computer?
Sure. All utilities in the U.S., whether large or small, and certainly Burlington Electric, take cybersecurity very seriously. It's something that we're looking at 24/7, 365. So when on Thursday the Department of Homeland Security issued some new information about possible threats, we uploaded it into our systems and began scanning our computers for any possible activity. On Friday morning, when an employee powered on the laptop, which was not connected to the electric grid controls that we have, some internet traffic that was suspicious was detected. It gave us a warning. We immediately isolated the computer, took it off the network, and contacted federal authorities. I want to emphasize really importantly, as I said, this was a laptop not connected to our electric grid control systems.
And when you say not connected, do you mean not connected at the time, or this is a computer that would never have been connected?
Never have been connected. We run a very different network for our electric grid control systems. This was on the business side of the house, not the grid control side of the house. But what we found is that there was absolutely no breach of our electric grid. There was no penetration of our electric grid, as the Washington Post reported incorrectly. And further, there's no indication of compromise of any customer data or of any of our electric control systems.
Can you tell us a little bit more about where this employee worked or what department? I'm guessing you don't want to tell the name. Maybe you're worried about the person, but, you know,
Well, no, there's always a balance. We take cybersecurity very seriously. And even talking about cybersecurity events with this much publicity does tend to give the bad actors out there a roadmap for what worked and what didn't. So we have tried to steer clear of getting into too much detail, and I'm going to continue to steer clear on this interview.
But you did say this was somebody who worked on, or the computer itself was on the business side of things, not ever connected to the grid.
That's correct. You know, one of our principal responsibilities are to maintain the reliability and integrity of our grid and protect our customer data. That's what we're doing every day here at Burlington Electric. We take that, you know, it's one of our top priorities. But the computer in question here was not connected to the grid control systems that we have.
I'm talking with Neil Lunderville, General Manager of Burlington Electric Department. And Neil, can you delineate a little bit further what the relationship is with the federal government that requires you to report this kind of thing, how they get in touch with you about what to look for, et cetera?
So we have all utilities, as I mentioned, take this seriously. We're working every day with various federal authorities to obtain new information of things that we should be looking for on our systems. We work with multiple agencies around the country. So they are giving us new information, and then when we see something that is suspect, we want to report it back to them because that gives them intel about what might be working or not. But I want to be really clear about this situation. There is no indication, and I've heard this from several federal authorities and experts in the field, there's no indication that what we found was specifically targeted for Burlington Electric or even for the utility sector. This guidance we got from the federal government was very broad. It The communication we saw was actually to a Yahoo.com web server, so it was a well-known web server that millions of Americans probably go to every day. And we really don't know much more than that, other than we flagged it and we reported it to the federal government. The fact of this story, the problem with this is that inaccurate information got leaked to the Washington Post, and the Washington Post ran with it before confirming that information with us, and which set off a cascade of events that's now in day four that we've been trying to assure our customers that there hasn't been any breach since Friday night.
What has that been like? Are your customers, I mean, everybody should be worried in the sense that if something was infiltrated, that would affect more than Burlington Electric customers. But it sounds like maybe your customers specifically, that this is having an effect on your business.
Well, we are here to make sure that our customers get safe and reliable and affordable power. We want to make sure that they are well taken care of. But we also have the best customers in the world. They have been calling, and they've been looking at our website and watching Twitter and Facebook. We've put statements out trying to combat these inaccurate reports. I think so far we've had good feedback from our customers who understand what the real story is. And we've been working with other utilities around the state to make sure their customers know that as collectively as an industry, we're working on cybersecurity 24/7, and we want to make sure that our customers' data is protected and that the grid is reliable and safe.
Neil, just before I let you go, you know, remarkably, the very last show Vermont Edition did before this one, before we took a holiday break, was about cybersecurity. And Dan Nelson of Velco told us that hackers attempt to infiltrate the grid hundreds of times a day, every day. And you have just said and made it very clear that there was no grid infiltration this time. But how can you possibly stay ahead, one step ahead of these hackers, if it's coming at you like a blizzard every day?
We spend a lot of time and a lot of resources, and we do a lot of coordination to do the best we can to stay ahead of the bad actors that are out there. It is really constant vigilance that is what's going to protect us from this, and also good coordination between all the different partners. One of the concerns I have out of this is a number of, you know, utility folks have said if the federal government is going to leak inaccurate information and cause problems like this, they suddenly are less inclined to share that information. You know, I've said we've got to resist that urge. We have to continue to work with the feds. We hope this was an isolated incident of the feds coming out with the wrong information and leaking it to the press. But we have to continue to cooperate, work together to protect our customers from any threats that are outside of our walls.
Neil Lunderville is general manager of Burlington Electric Department, and it is a municipally owned utility that made national news this past weekend when Russian hackers infiltrated one of the company's computers. Neil, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Jane. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. And listeners, I did mention our cybersecurity show of December 23rd. And if you are interested in listening to that, you can find the whole podcast or go to vpr.net/Vermont Edition. You don't have to travel far, even in Vermont, or investigate very deeply to understand that our agricultural and food systems run on large-scale commodity farming. Now, our version of large-scale is nothing compared to the large-scale farms in the West and the Midwest, but still, we do operate mostly on conventional models. That's how most people get their milk, from corn-fed dairy cows who don't leave their barns. It's how most people continue to get their meat, and most of our vegetables come from far away, usually other countries. The locavore movement and renewed interest in small-scale local farming have given life to a conversation around how we farm and what impact our farming has on animals, people, the land, water. One way of looking at these questions is regenerative agriculture. This goes beyond just organic to look at the whole ecosystem. Today on the program, we're going to learn about this concept, push a little bit on whether or not this could ever be a predominant model in this region and beyond. And I'm joined now by Graham Unangst-Rufenacht. He's the lead organizer of Rural Vermont and the owner of Robinson Hill Beef Farm in Calais. He's also a regenerative farming consultant. Hi, Graham. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
And by Michael Colby. He co-founded Regeneration Vermont and owns Walden Maple Company. Michael, nice to have you on the program.
It's great to be here.
Graham, if I drive by, say, a dairy farm that's practicing regenerative agriculture and I'm just driving through town, is anything going to look different to me on the driver's side as I breeze by than that conventional dairy farm down the road that I saw 10 minutes ago?
Absolutely, depending on the practices employed by the conventional dairy farm. But you'd see a farm where cattle are based in pasture, where cattle are being moved frequently based on grass height, based on the health of the land. You would see pastures that weren't eaten down to nubbins of grass, in which you have runoff, in which you have soil compaction. You would see a pasture which is growing topsoil over time, which is growing the capacity to hold massive amounts of water, which is flood and drought resistance and resilience. You'd see healthier animals. You would also see a product that has higher omega-3 to 6 fatty acid ratios, higher conjugated linoleic acid ratios, basically a healthier product in general.
That's a lot to see when I drive by.
That is a lot to see.
Michael, can you sort of give us the bird's eye view then of this idea and the goal and the ideal of regenerative agriculture?
Yeah, and I think we should probably back up and see what model we're in now, and you know, because we're in a hole, and the first thing you need to do when you're in a hole is stop digging. And the conventional commodity-based dairy that we're now following is devastating to Vermont farmers. The price being paid to dairy farmers now in the conventional model is less than it costs them to produce. Currently, they're getting about $16 a hundredweight to sell that milk. It's costing them about $22 a hundredweight to produce that milk. It's devastating, and something needs to change, and we need to focus on not only the price being paid to farmers, which is less than it costs them to produce, but then what that model is doing in terms of pesticide use, GMO corn use, the migrant justice issues on these farms, the rural culture. You drive around rural Vermont now and you see these ghost towns. In the last 40 or 50 years, we've lost about 700 farms per county in the state of Vermont. These are small businesses. These are families that work the land that wasn't just a job. It was a way of life. And when you have that kind of impact, the ripples are not just happening from food production, but all throughout the culture, from family health to land health to water health. Look at Lake Champlain. We're currently facing, because of this model, a bill for $1.25 billion, which is the portion that dairy farming is responsible for polluting the water. That's a lot of money, and that's the external costs above and beyond of what's happening to the environment from this kind of farming.
And you're looking specifically there at dairy, and regenerative agriculture, of course, goes beyond just dairy, can be any kind of farming, but the ideals are the opposite of what you just said, so that you are looking at ecosystem health, you're looking at soil health, you're looking at farm worker health, you're looking at having native plants and animals have a space within that farming landscape, and that's all possible while also feeding people?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's about understanding the importance of soil. It's about understanding the importance of water quality, animal health. I mean, let's look at the cows. In the last 30 or 40 years, the average dairy cow gave about 7,000 pounds of milk in the 1970s. Today, the average dairy cow is given about 23,000 pounds of milk. That's a 300% increase. It's having a devastating impact on the cow's health. The average cow life expectancy of a dairy cow is now 6 years. A healthy cow on a regenerative farm that sees grass, that eats healthy food, can live close to 20 years. So you add all this stuff up. That's what I'm talking about. We got to stop digging the hole. We know this model is not working. We need to focus on it. We need to move away from it. And what Regeneration Vermont, my organization, is trying to do is trying to put together a plan to get us out of this hole and move toward a more regenerative, sustainable form of agriculture and food production.
That is what we're talking about today, this idea of regenerative agriculture. Its advocates say profitable farming and keeping the entire ecosystem in balance are not mutually exclusive ideals. We'd like to know what questions you have about this approach. You can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. It's 800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Graham, why is social justice and this idea of fair wages, farmer health, farm worker health, a part of this? You know, often when you look at farming practices, this idea of how farm workers are paid, for example, is seen sort of separately. And my understanding of regenerative agriculture is that that's actually part of this whole idea.
Absolutely. I think Michael spoke a little to that. But the idea is that agroecology, regenerative agriculture, this isn't just a suite of technical practices. This has a political, socio-political, economic meaning. And we see this throughout the Global South as well in larger landless workers movements like Via Campesina, who have for years been pushing this notion of agroecology as a political movement, as something which has to do not only with the well-being, with being able to change the practices which influence the well-being of our ecological systems, but which also take into consideration the well-being of our communities, the sovereignty of our communities, the ability to produce food for each other with a suite of regulations that we've determined for ourselves and which benefit us in our within an economic model, which actually uses indicators which measure human rights, which measure social well-being, which measure personal well-being, which measure ecological integrity.
It sounds a little bit, you know, on the surface, like this is a movement that sort of takes us back to old school farming, or at least farming before there was so much mechanization that you could do it on a really large scale. And before there were so many mouths to feed that we needed to have this sort of, you know, commodity farming that had an economy of scale that was done on the smallest land area, but for the most production. Is it really possible? And I understand you're not trying to go back in time here, but is it really possible to have practices that require grass grazing and, you know, all of these ways that you're incorporating landscape health while also feeding all of the mouths that do need to be fed? Graham?
I would say it's not only possible, but it's necessary. Like Michael was saying, cattle's health are dependent on eating fresh grass, on being in their natural environment. Human health is dependent on eating food that is good for us, and having access to land, and having access to health care, and having access to the political process. To continue going down what Michael describes as this devastating road is just not a future that we can actually afford.
And Michael, you agree? You think we can actually do this? We can feed the world with regenerative agriculture?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. We need to rethink the economics. There is a lot of money in food production. Let's just talk about it right now. We'll mention the two big dairy corporations that where all this money is going, Ben and Jerry's and Cabot.
In Vermont. Those are the two big ones, only here.
Yeah, we'll just focus right here. Our big dairy corporations, Ben and Jerry's, made over $600 million last year. Cabot and its parent, Agrimark, made over $1 billion last year. There's plenty of money in dairy. It's not trickling down to the dairy farmers. The dairy farmers are actually paying to farm. They're paying to farm. Just let that sink in for a minute. While the Ben and Jerry's and Cabot's are making enormous amounts of money. The CEO of Unilever, since 2009, has had his salary go up almost 300%, from $4 million a year to $12 million a year. In that same time period, the amount of money paid to the farmers supplying Ben and Jerry's with their milk has gone down almost 20%.
And I take your point, but I also want to just point out Unilever is a huge multinational company corporation, and Ben & Jerry's is a small part of that entire multinational.
A small part that makes $600 million a year and pays its farmers less than it costs them to produce the milk. So when we're talking about changing, the best way I like to describe it is when you ask a Vermonter, how do you think we farm in Vermont? And what visions we get is kind of what we see on the Ben & Jerry's truck, what we see on the Cabot truck, the cow on the pasture, on the rolling field with the clean water. That's the image that we need to make the reality. Because right now, we have that image. They're marketing that image. They're making enormous amount of money worldwide selling these products based on a false image. We're simply saying, let's put some reality into it. We can do it. We know how to do it, and we know what the benefits are. It's just a matter of getting over this stuck place that we're in, which is keep trying to put Band-Aids after Band-Aids after Band-Aids on a disastrous system that Vermont can't compete in. We can't compete with the dairies in the West and the Midwest that have tens of thousands of cows producing in the same manner that we're trying to produce here with our rolling hills and our climate. We just need to call the game and move on, and that's what we're trying to do. We're not saying our plan is perfect, but we're saying let's start discussing the plan. Let's move forward and let the benefit all of us.
All right, so coming up on the program, we're going to continue this conversation. We're going to look at how this works in practice. We're going to talk with one farmer who's using regenerative practices. We're also going to talk about this idea, though, the tension between how much it costs to do this kind of farming practice and what happens to consumers. Are we creating a tiered system where those who can afford ethical buying practices are going to be able to buy this kind of food and those who can't won't? Our number, 800-639-2211, or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're learning about the concept of regenerative agriculture today with Graham Unangst-Rufenacht, lead organizer of Rural Vermont and the owner of Robinson Hill Beef Farm in Calais, and Michael Colby, co-founder of Regeneration Vermont and the owner of Walden Maple Company. Listeners, if you have a question or an experience to share, you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 800-639-2211. So what does this look like on the ground? Let's get the perspective now of Jack Laser. On his farm in Westfield, Butterworks Farm, he put some of these concepts into practice. You might see Butterworks yogurt or buttermilk in your local store, and Jack's on the line with us now. Hi, Jack.
Hi there.
So what do you actually do that is helping to get to these concepts that we've been discussing? What does that actually mean in terms of the work you do on your farm?
Well, what we've done here is, over the years, we've learned some lessons, and one of the lessons we've learned, because I'm also a grain farmer, and so I do tillage, but we have two farms, so we've got, you know, some river bottom land where we've been growing, you know, wheat for human consumption and making flour and cornmeal and that sort of thing, and then, you know, the home farm is up in the hills on a high plateau with glacial soils that are a little on the stony side, but they're loamy and they're good, so we have basically been growing all the grain in the river bottom, and with a good, what we thought was a good rotation, with some clover in the rotation now and then, but, you know, corn, soybeans, and grain. And a couple of years ago, we started noticing in our soil tests that the organic matter levels on the river bottom land, which is probably some of the best soils around, you know, alluvial floodplain type soils, was only in the 1.5 to 2% range, and the soils on our home farm were 8 to 9% organic matter. And because we haven't tilled them in 20 to 30 years, and we've left them in grass, and so this past summer when we had all the dry weather, you know, we really were barely impacted by it here. I mean, we didn't brown out anywhere. I mean, we had to use a little bit more land for pasture. And we made the decision last winter, a year ago, to stop feeding grain to our cows and to do what we would call 100% grass-fed farming, which has, you know, been a bit of a learning curve for us too. But it's all working quite well. So my belief is that what we do is we keep our cows, instead of in a free stall with no bedding, we keep them in a big hoop barn, and they're on a bedding, what they call a bedding pack. We use our own straw and some hay that we cut down and some wood bark and things like that, and we just keep putting the bedding out there every day. Cows come into the barn to get milked. They go out back out to their, we call it their winter pasture, and they're on this bedding pack. But we've got a lot more carbon in the equation than, say, a conventional or even a regular organic farm that's using a manure pit. And then all this material that the cows are on, which gets to be about 6 feet deep, is basically is hauled out in the summertime and put in long rows and turned once or twice and made into compost, which is in turn spread on the fields in September but we only go out once a year to spread our manure on the farm, on our land, and we've been able to build organic matter in that fashion. And
Jack, that's really interesting, because it's, you know, you're giving us sort of a really concrete idea here of an actual practice, which is super helpful, because, you know, so what do you actually do? And you have this bedding for the cows, and the cows get to, do their business on that bedding all winter, and then you're turning that into fertilizer, natural fertilizer for the soil once a year. Jack, you always have a ton to tell us, and I know I'm going to keep you short today, but I appreciate you giving us an extra little tidbit here on how it works on your farm, Butterworks Farm in Westfield. Jack, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care.
We are talking about regenerative agriculture today. If you have a thought or a question, you can call 800-639-2211. Let's go to Jesse in Shaftesbury. Hi, Jesse. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So what do you do? Where do you come at this conversation?
I'm a farmer in Shaftesbury. I'm working on a fourth generation farm. We've been a hay farm for 80 years. We have spent the last 4 years transitioning from conventional management using tillage and chemicals of the hay to regenerative ag, and I just wanted to call in and give an example of economically the success of these practices.
Well, Jesse, go ahead. It's working for you economically?
Absolutely. We've been able to put down the expense of chemical management and tillage in the hay fields, and instead of buying those inputs every year, we've brought in sheep and chickens and turkeys to rotate through the fields very carefully, and that has brought our production up now above where it was with chemical management. But not only that, we're producing more hay, but we're producing more calories per acre in the sheep and chickens and turkeys and pastured meat. So we've been able to create a huge economic swing for the farm in the last 4 years.
Jesse, interesting to hear that. I appreciate it. And, you know, it leads us to this question of not just how can you make money for the farm, but, you know, how do we make this affordable for consumers? And, you know, we have this conversation when we talk about organic, too, which gets a higher price from consumers. And Graham and Michael, I'd like to get your sense then of how we have this balance between what it costs to do this kind of farming. You know, and Jesse says this is working out economically well for him, but I presume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is probably, at least in the short term, going to be more expensive. To transition to these practices is expensive, to transition your farm over. And, you know, the way to make money by doing that is to pass that on to consumers. And are we creating a tiered system where the person who's a single mom just trying to get healthy food for her kids and is looking at that yogurt is going to say, I'm trying to buy plain whole milk yogurt for my kids, but I need to buy it as cheaply as possible. I don't have the ability to think about this on the same ethical level. I don't have the money that it's going to take as a consumer to buy this kind of food when, as Michael pointed out, we can get our food from the farms in the Midwest that are doing really large-scale agriculture more cheaply. Graham, do you have a way that all balances out?
Well, I think we unfortunately do have a tiered system like that, but I wouldn't say it's because of the practices. I would say it's actually because of some of the policies and the economic situation that Michael so well articulated earlier. The money is not in the hands of the ecological farmers to the detriment of the customers. The money is in the hands of the people at the top of these food system consolidated companies, and it's not making its way down to any of us. And I think Jesse's call was great because it illustrates how he's doing economically better using ecological farming practices, regenerative farming practices, but he didn't necessarily say whether or not his farm was yet economically viable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a larger conversation we need to have in Vermont, period, is farming, period, viable? Ecological farming certainly is more viable. Even the U.S. Department of Agriculture acknowledges that smaller farmers produce more food per hectare, whether measured in weight, sales, or calories. But still, is the production of food in economically something you can make a just livelihood off of?
And if it isn't, what do? Turn it over to the government? I mean, we all still have to eat.
No, and I'd say this is also, as you said at the beginning, you know, Rural Vermont is an organization I work with. And one of the things that we're doing this spring is going out around the state. And we're going to have conversations with communities sort of based on a populist education model. And we're going to give a little bit of this analysis that we've shared today about regenerative agriculture and the economic state of farmers and the food system, like this dynamic you're articulating, Jane, where at once farmers aren't making enough on their food and consumers are also struggling to pay for ecologically farmed food that they feel is healthier for them. And we tend to go out to people and say, here's the situation as we see it, but more importantly, what is your read in the situation? What are the needs that you experience in your community? If you're a farmer, what are the barriers you face to making a just livelihood, to transitioning to regenerative practices? If you're a consumer, what are the barriers you face to accessing food? What are the barriers you face to also your having a just livelihood in your community, to accessing healthcare, to whatever it is? Because I think this conversation needs to go beyond, like you said, referring it to the government, to the state house. We can't wait for Washington or Montpelier. It needs to go beyond just the organizational level, whether it's Regeneration Vermont or Rural Vermont. And it needs to go down to the actual people of Vermont. And we need to start talking amongst ourselves about how we're going to develop systems that are actually achieve these goals of a healthy world to live in, just livelihoods, and regenerative agriculture that supports these things.
Michael, I'll come back to you, but on the line with us right now, we have Juan Alves, UVM's Pasture Program Technical Coordinator. And Juan, are you helping farmers do these kinds of transitions to the type of practices that we're talking about today?
Yes, definitely, Jen. UVM Extension in general works around the state on a variety of topics and with a diversity of partners in different programs across Vermont. I work at the Center for Sustainable Agriculture, where, you know, basically we try to advance sustainability of food and farming systems. And the regenerative agriculture topic is on the table every day, basically. At the pasture program, we promote and enhance sustainable-based, grass-based livestock farming through improvements in soil, forages. We also tackle water quality. But we never forget about profitability or farm viability, because it's one of the legs of sustainability.
So you think this is a possible way for Vermont farmers to convert or to continue moving in this direction towards regenerative agriculture and have sustainable practices and viable farms?
Yes, most definitely. I think we need to emulate how natural systems work and merge into a journey that defends process-based instead of input-based agriculture. To give you an example, our society's well-being depends on healthy ecosystems, and basically healthy ecosystems need a sound structure so that different processes can enable function and, in general, benefit society. An example of that would be if we lose habitats, for instance, forests or soil loss, we increase pest damage, we can increase nutrient runoff, and we decrease fertility and water quality. So everything is connected to everything. The good thing is that we have solutions in the way. So
Let me stop you there, because, you know, when you're talking about these solutions, and I'm sorry to cut you off, you know, this is sort of the wheelhouse for our guests, Graham and Michael. And Michael, I'm going to give you the last word today on this idea of, you know, what is the ultimate goal then? Because you mentioned we're not going to be able to compete with these farms in the Midwest. So is this the model that you see for Vermont or for everybody?
For everybody, but we're going to start here, and we have to make farming viable again. The current model is not working. It is devastating to our farm economy and our farm families, and we need to dig out of it, and we need to put a sustainable, regenerative face on the future of farming, and we can begin right here in Vermont. It's very doable, very viable.
Well, we're going to continue to have this conversation. As we know, a new head of the Agency of Agriculture coming in soon, Anson Tebbets. We'll get him on the program at some point to talk about this. And, you know, we'll continue to have this conversation between conventional farming and other methods and this idea of where does Vermont go with agriculture. That was Michael Colby, who co-founded Regeneration Vermont and owns Walden Maple Company. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Graham Unangst-Rufenacht is the lead organizer of Rural Vermont and owner of Robinson Hill Beef Farm in Calais. Thanks to you as well, Graham.
Thanks, Jane.
Coming up, VPR's Amy Noyes takes us to Shelburne, where sixth graders from the Vermont Common School are reading an adventure story by a Vermont author. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. And now it's time for Dorothy's List, our feature about the books nominated for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. VPR's Amy Noyce takes us to Shelburne now, where sixth graders from the Vermont Common School are reading an adventure story by Vermont author Kekla Magoon.
Students file into Pearson Library and head up a short set of stairs to a grand room, Shelburne's historic town hall. They settle into a rectangle of tables and chairs that are the only furnishings in the echoey old meeting hall. The sixth grade class is here to discuss Shadows of Sherwood, the first book in the Robin Hoodlum Adventure series. As you might have guessed, the series is inspired by the stories of Robin Hood, but the Robin and Kekla Magoon stories spells her name with a Y. And her home in the dystopian, futuristic Knot City is a far cry from Nottingham, England. We asked the students to imagine questions for the book's author, and sixth grader Emmett Klein Lucy starts with the basics.
How did you come up with the idea for basing it off of the original Robin Hood myth?
We put Emmett's question and questions from the other Vermont Common School students to author Kekla Magoon.
I've always really liked Robin Hood as a character. I've liked Robin Hood stories. I like the idea of Robin Hood, where he's kind of an outlaw, he's mischievous, but he has a good heart, and he's actually trying to help people in the process. And so I sort of like that line between doing what's right and following the rules. And so Robin Hood really plays with that line between what's right and what you're told is right and what you know is right in your heart, and what the laws are versus what is really kind and generous. And so I hope that Robin Hood can be an inspiration to people to kind of push boundaries and try to find ways to help each other and support each other.
Sixth grader Sophie Richardson Shepherd wants to know more about the author's motivation to write three books about this character.
What gave you the inspiration for the Robin Hoodlum series?
I grew up watching the Disney version of Robin Hood, where Robin Hood and Maid Marian are foxes, and it's a musical, and there are lots of other animals in the story. And I really loved that. And so as an adult, I have written a lot of pretty serious books. I write books about the civil rights movement. I write books about race relations in the United States and about the history of Black people in the United States. And sometimes those topics are really serious and heavy, and they're important to me. But it can be tiring sometimes to write about very serious things all the time. So I thought I wanted to write something more fun and lighthearted. And that's when my mind reminded me of what I liked when I was a kid. And so I decided I'm going to write a story about Robin Hood, but I'm going to reimagine her as a biracial teenage girl living in a city. So not the white man outlaw from England of, the old stories, but a new version of Robin Hood for the 21st century.
But Magoon discovered that lighthearted story from her childhood had some familiar themes.
I realized in the process of working on Robin that even though I thought this was going to be a fun, lighthearted story that was different from everything I usually write, it's actually based on the same concepts of social justice and making sure that everybody has what they need and taking care of each other in your community. And that's a lot of what I write about all the time.
In Shadows of Sherwood, Robin's parents are kidnapped and possibly killed by an authoritarian governor looking to become an autocratic ruler. Robin joins forces with some other kids who have been left to fend for themselves, and together they decide to redistribute the government's stockpiles to people living in a homeless encampment. Or, if you like, they take from the rich to give to the poor. Sound familiar? Robin develops a knack for breaking into government compounds, as she does in this scene read by author Kekla Magoon.
The sign on the fence said, "Beware of dogs." Robin scaled it anyway. Dogs? As in plural, she thought, as she laced her fingers in the chain link, wedged the toes of her boots into the diamond-shaped spaces, and climbed. That could be a problem. There were plenty of problems tonight. She had spotted six different guards patrolling the inside perimeter of the enclosed lot. That was three times the usual. Normally, staying unseen was easy and fun. Dodging the guards was all part of the adventure. Now, scaling the fence, Robin felt a hint of trepidation. Things were not as they ought to be. Had she missed something? Robin kept on climbing, though her mind ticked around the problems at hand. Guards. Guns. And how many dogs, exactly?
In Shadows of Sherwood, Robin's dad has left her a series of clues to help her solve the mystery of what is happening as her world tightens around her. Some of it's prophesized in what they call the moon lore, which is filled with imagery of shadows and light. One piece of the puzzle that Robin's dad leaves behind is an old map. Back at the Pearson Library, sixth grader Anouk von Bernowitz thought it was pretty realistic.
is the map of the city based off of somewhere that you've been in your life? Because that map was very detailed and had certain places like the treehouse and the Loxley Manor. And I was just wondering if that was based off of anything that you've seen in real life.
The map in the story is something that I made up, and it's not based on any real place in the real world. It's based on my imagination of what Robin's world looks like.
But here's a secret that readers of Shadows of Sherwood might not realize about that map.
So if you look at where everything is placed on the map in the book, you can see that some of the most important places on the map kind of form a triangle. There's like a kind of an arrow pattern to it because there's arrow symbolism in Robin Hood. And so she goes through her adventures in the first book, the second book, and then the third book. She starts putting together the different pieces about the way the city is laid out and the way that the different special locations on her map fit together and how they're going to help her to fight the battle that she needs to fight.
Magoon says even though the setting isn't real, it's still important to Robin's story. And Shelburne sixth grader Noah McCauley is looking for connections between real life and Robin's world.
How does Shadows of Sherwood correspond or have parallels to your life?
There are a number of parallels, I think. I think the character of Robin, first of all, she is biracial. I see her as biracial, that her dad is black and her mom is white. And that's what my life is like. My mom is white and my dad is black. My dad's from Cameroon, actually, from West Africa. And so part of the symbolism of Robin Hood is the idea of black and white coming together and sort of bridging differences. And that's something that I feel is part of my life experience of being biracial and seeing myself as partly white and partly black. And so Robin has a bit of exploration of that through some of the clues that she gets as part of the moon lore, which is the faith tradition of her community. And those elements are sort of something that comes out of a part of who I am, even though it's not the way that those things manifest in our real world. It's just a way of representing it in the story.
The character Robin really knows how to stir up trouble. Sixth grader Charlie Melamede wondered how closely Magoon modeled Robin after herself.
We went on your website, and it didn't look like you were the mischievous type, but I was just curious about that.
It's true. I was not a kid that was very mischievous. I was a kid who wished I was very mischievous. And so I think, you know, Robin is partly me in certain ways. She has certain parts of my personality, but she also has a lot of characteristics that I wish I had, or characteristics that are that I sort of tend toward, but that are not as strong in me as they are in Robin, which means sometimes I'm a little bit brave. So I made Robin extremely brave. And sometimes I am a little bit acrobatic. So I made Robin extremely acrobatic. Actually, I'm a little more clumsy. So that might be just me wishing that I was cooler in some of those ways. But a lot of it is about how I wish I could be, right? It's a fantasy. It's about, you know, somebody who's stronger and braver and smarter and more clever and sort of able to trick people and able to use her power in all these different ways. And I want to aspire to be more like Robin in certain ways. And I think that she does draw inspiration from me, but not just from who I actually am, but also who I would like to be.
Some of the sixth graders from Vermont Common School drew parallels between the political turmoil in Robin's story and rhetoric from the recent presidential campaign. That led Andrzej Mattel Skiff to ask.
And I was wondering if you had any inspiration from the presidential campaign season when writing your book.
Magoon said she could see where the readers might find some similarities, but the timing is off.
When I was writing the first book, Shadows of Sherwood, it was a long time before the election season of 2016. I was writing this book back in 2012 and 2013. And at that time, I was thinking about not any specific political situation, either in this country or in other countries around the world. I was thinking about a very broad picture of how people use and abuse power. And that's a theme that has recurred over time in all different parts of the world. And so I think that might be part of why Robin Hood is such an iconic story, why Robin Hood is a story that's very popular and keeps being told over and over again, because in lots of different ways, in lots of different places, there are situations where communities feel oppressed or communities feel like they're struggling against the people that are in power.
So even though she didn't draw inspiration from any current political situation, Magoon says Robin Hood tales offer some timeless lessons that are applicable today.
And so Robin Hood's story, both in Shadows of Sherwood, in my series, and Robin Hood's story historically, have been about how the people can sort of exert their will against people in power and how communities can fight for what's right against, you know, people who do not necessarily have their best interests at heart. And so I think that's really important for us all to keep in mind how we can be part of the political landscape, how we can make a difference, how we can fight for what we believe in and fight to take care of each other. And I think that that's true regardless of what's going on in the present political moment.
There are always different ways that people can use their power, Kekla Magoon says, summing up a theme of her books. And she tells these sixth graders, I think we all need to learn to use our power for good. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
The book is Shadows of Sherwood by Vermont author Kekla Magoon. Thanks to Vermont Common School teacher Jory Hurst and Kathy Townsend and the staff at Pearson Library. Next month, Dorothy's List will visit the St. Johnsbury Athenaeum, where readers will be discussing the graphic novel Roller Girl by Victoria Jameson. A little over half of all Vermonters have signed up to be organ donors, but there's still a big shortage of viable organs for all the people who need them. Tomorrow, we'll investigate how likely it is that a donor's body would actually be used to save someone's life. Tune in for that conversation live tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.